Thank you. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Join KBOO this Friday, May 1st at 11 a.m. for KBOO's first online live webinar and Q&A. The subject is COVID-19 in Palestine and Israel. We will hear from guest speakers like Dr. Osama Tenos, a pediatrician specialist based in Haifa, Richard Silverstein of the Jewish Bloc Tikkun Olam, and Dr. Yasser Abu Jahameh, the Director General for Gaza Community Mental Health Program. Our speakers will discuss the conditions for Palestinians inside the West Bank and Israel, as well as highlight the broader implication for any nation and any minority group in the world fighting against the virus. For more information and registration for this event, go to kboo.fm/KBOO webinar. You must register online. For any questions, please email Public Affairs Director Tammy Updates at publicaffairs@kboo.org. Again, that's COVID-19 in Palestine and Israel KBOO webinar, Friday, May 1st at 11 a.m.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. Stick with us as we play you music, throwback interviews, and more. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you on the other side, Indian Country. We now continue for part two of the Vine Deloria Jr. Lecture Series on Native American Mascots, recorded in 2014 by Rose City Native Radio, with panelists Greg Deal, Cornell Pee-wee Wardy, Sayautum Edmo, and Charlene Teeters, moderated by Dr. Adrian Keene. Enjoy.
So I kind of wanted to give the story of what happened here locally to folks. Coming into this, I'm gonna just ask for everybody's forgiveness in front, because there are a few people in the audience that I would love to just call out, and y'all know who you are, so I don't, well, anyway. So there are a few people in the audience who have had a big role in what's happened here locally, and so I might just ask each of them to stand when I ask them to. So here is a presentation that I gave, that I recreated for today, but you know, the next big thing in activism, or the next big community activism in the 21st century. So basically this is the story of how OIEA, an organization that really, we have an operating budget of less than $7,000 a year. We put on a little conference, we hang out together somewhere, and that's pretty much it. We have a dinner or two, and we give some scholarships to kids. That's all we really do. That was our function, or our primary function. And this is just, it's five simple chapters. There's only 12 slides here. But really, it looks a little bit at the history of this issue, in particular, grounding us here in Oregon. Chapter two is the champions and the beginning of the movement here as it happened starting in 2006. Chapter three is coalition building and mobilization. Chapter four is testimony and public comment. And then chapter five is the vote of the State Board of Education and what the work looks like going into the future. So chapter one is history. I spilled the beans a little bit earlier and let you all know that, so my dad went to the Dalles High School. This is an actual picture from his yearbook. I've been told that there are some copyright issues with this, but anyway, he's sharing it with you all. Pretend that you're in his living room. So these are actual, they're like Indianettes or something. So they're like the dance team, right? That's who they are. And you'll see the women down there in the front have their headdresses on. So the Indian mascots in Oregon started to be on the rise back in the 1930s to the 1950s is when you saw most of the Indian mascots be adopted by particular schools here in Oregon. And if any of you who are from Oregon know the history of Oregon, that was an very intense time of racial hatred towards Indian people. So actual Indian people, right? So this idea that, oh, we're honoring you and that's what this is all about. So it wasn't. That's not what this was about. This was, we want you to be Indian in the way we want you to be Indian, and then we don't want you to be Indian in any other way. Politically, we don't want you to organize, we don't want to hear you, we don't want to see you in our restaurants, we don't want to see you in the library, we don't want to see you in our pool or when we go to the movies. We want to see you when we make you, when we want you to dance in front of our sports games. And that's how you are an Indian. That's your limit. So that's the environment that my father grew up in the Dalles. Here he is. So there he is down front. They had him put on his regalia, and that's the only way he could participate in sports, was if he agreed to dance before he was then in sports, in that particular sport. So he would put on his regalia, and in this particular caption from this photo, it actually says Casey Edmo mascot. So he would sit in front of, this isn't even his team or his age bracket, this was, he was in grade school and they were in high school, and they made him sit for the photo as their mascot. Here, this is another pep club. Their chant was "How." So chapter two is, so that's a little bit of the history. The other thing I think to point out is, you know, nowhere in the United States was termination felt the way it was in Oregon. 99% of the Indian individuals losing their federal status were from Oregon. And so that was a real intense thing here. The person that you see in front of you, it's Shea Butler. He, in 2006, was a high school student at Taft High School. He's a member of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, and he went to go play the Warrenton Warriors. And during halftime, at a halftime show, what happened was his sister and his younger brother witnessed somebody dressed up like an Indian who had a bullseye painted on his chest. And Che just got mad. He was like, what? I'm in the middle, you know, I'm here with my family. Why is this guy dressing up and acting like he's, you know, trying to do some dance out in the middle of this basketball? It was embarrassing. And so that really got him, you know, got him going. He was like, this has got to stop. We can't be bringing our families to an event like this and have this happening. School is not the place for something like this to be happening, for somebody to be making fun of who I am, where I come from, how I practice my religion, and it just has no place on the playing field or anywhere in school. So that's Che, and he immediately, you know, his family is politically savvy, so he immediately went to the State Board of Education and said, hey, look, this has got to change. And the State Board said, okay, we see some of the issues with this, but we don't want to do anything too hasty. We want to talk to the tribes first. So then this kind of waiting period began back in 2006. Where the State Board of Education said, okay, so we'll pass this resolution that basically encourage schools to adopt new mascots. Okay, so that started back then, and it didn't go anywhere, surprisingly. They were like, oh, schools were like, that's nice, they want to encourage us to do this, but our community doesn't want it, so we're not going to do anything. Then something interesting happened. Brenda Frank, who you'll see in another picture, was appointed to the State Board of Education by the governor. And they said, you know what, if we're gonna tackle, the State Board came back to the Oregon Indian Education Association and said, hey, if we're gonna do this anytime in the future, now is the time to do it. So enter in Seattle, you know, bright-eyed and full of energy into OIEA, And they said, so Allison Ball here is in the background. She was the president of the Oregon Indian Education Association at the time. And we were all in this board meeting together, and she said, okay, so this mascot issue is going to come up, so who wants it? And it was like that. Good job. That was the meeting. That was, and I was like way in the back, and I was like, oh no, I don't want this. Because the thing about me, here's the thing. I rode here in a Jeep Cherokee. And in that Jeep Cherokee, Duke Harjo is back there shaking his head in that Jeep Cherokee, so he, because he knows my husband, and here's why. So here, I rode here in a Jeep Cherokee, and in that Jeep Cherokee, there is a faux dream catcher with the Washington team logo on it. My husband is a die-hard Washington football team fan, die-hard. I mean, he grew up with Duke in Washington, D.C., and he loved him. He loved him. And for those of you who don't know Duke there at the back, and now's your time, now's your part. There, wave, everybody. Duke Harjo. Reed grad, former Reedie, also happens to be Suzanne Harjo's son. So Suzanne, we all know, and those of us who are hip to the mascot history, it is one of our national level activists. And she is the one who actually mentored me through a lot of this kind of political game that was happening back and forth with the State Board of Education. I mean, literally, I would email her at like 3 a.m. and she'd answer. I'm like, when do you sleep? I don't know. Like, I'm tired. I get tired and I sleep, but I don't know when she does. So anyway, here we were. Brenda was the chair of the State Board of Education. Allison said, it's time to go. It's go time. This is it. And here I am in the OIEA board meeting going, don't pick me. Don't pick me. I don't want, don't pick me. Don't pick me. And Allison was like, see, Autumn, you can handle something like this. And I was like, oh gosh. So I go home to my husband. I'm like, so now I'm chair of this mascot committee. He was so not happy with me. He's like, you did this on purpose. Why are you doing this? Because all of those years that my husband grew up in Washington, D.C., he was the one who, in like the living room conversation, that was like, no, I don't see the problem with it. Y'all are blowing this out of proportion. There's no issue. So anyway, that's who he was. So here we were at this really critical time. We could possibly have the votes, and that's when OIEA came to the State Board of Education. The idea was reintroduced, and this time, because our Oregon legislature gives the State Board of Education the power of law. So when you if you're on the State Board of Education, you make a rule, that rule is an Oregon administrative rule and carries the weight of law. So they said, you know, we looked at this issue 6 years ago, nobody's changed, and now we've got to do something about this. We gave you school districts some time to mull this over, and you did nothing. And nothing isn't good. Nothing isn't good enough. You had no conversations. You made no effort to even bring up this issue within your local communities. So that's when we came back to the State Board of Education. And we did that with a number of important folks. Here on the left, or on the right, is Dr. Andre Brown, who is a leader in the American Psychological Association. He runs their minority fellowship programs and is on that committee. And he came and testified. What was important was having, not doing what you were saying, we weren't having like only the good Indians versus the bad Indians. We were up there as kind of a united front of very diverse communities. communities of color. We also had the support of Basic Rights Oregon, the statewide lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights organization, saying, you know what, hey, if you target one type of person in the classroom, kids are smart. They know that they can make other people targets, and that behavior is then normalized. So they were like, yeah, we don't want any normalization of discrimination happening in any public school. So we built our coalition. There's Brenda, there she is, Klamath Tribes, and also with Nez Perce ancestry as well. So basically, we had a couple of months, and our job was to convince six people to pass this new resolution. So let's see, there's a little bit about I already covered all that, but. So it was a quick turnaround. The timeline, we began the issue on March 8th, and then 2 months later, the board voted. And boom, in a span of 2 months, Oregon had the strictest law in the nation against the use of Indian mascots in schools. Yeah. And there's one caveat to that. So those of you who follow the news here in Oregon, you know that Senate Bill 1509 just passed. And it's what I call the mascot loophole bill. And that is, it creates now kind of a window for, there are a couple of tribes in particular. One, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz, ironically where Che is from, that have an Indian mascot. Their charter school has an Indian mascot, and they want the right to represent themselves the way that they want to. And then the other tribe is the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. So they in particular weren't very happy with the State Board of Education, and also me in particular. And all of those comments, like it started getting real during this time. So the other thing that happened during this time is I got pregnant with my third child. And you know, having heard about other folks and seeing stories of folks in the past who are threatened, you know, there was this point of realization, I think, when my husband switched, and that was March 8th. I came home from being in Salem all day long, and here I was in my first trimester. I was exhausted, right? In your first trimester, you sleep a lot, you form the placenta, all these things are happening. And I was exhausted, and the biggest win, we could have lost the vote 2 months later and I didn't care, but the biggest win was walking through that front door and having him say, I will never purchase another Redskins thing ever in my life. And I was like, yay! So that means my kids don't have t-shirts, like I can like rest assured that nothing ever is going to be crossing the threshold into our home. What's there will be there, the 8 jerseys hanging in our closet, they'll stay, but that was our compromise, and I stick by it, and I hope that other folks, you know, especially locally, come to a place where they can appreciate that listening towards one another. I mean, I was called all sorts of things in the news. Like, people were saying all sorts of nasty stuff about me in comments. And I know my friend Sam Sachs back there by the video camera, wave to everybody, Sam. He was my partner in crime. We would ride to say, we had a regular schedule. Hey, what time are you leaving? When are you going? We'd ride together down to Salem, come back. We were there every time. If there was a public comment, we were there. If there was an opportunity to give testimony, we were there. We were calling each other. We were texting other people. We were filling the car and going back and forth there for those couple of months. But yeah, so it was definitely intense. But my husband was the biggest win, and my kids were the biggest win. Making sure that they grew up in a place where they wouldn't have to play other teams. You know, my father, when he was a when he was a kid, he had to come to my high school games, right, and watch me play other teams who were the Indians. And I, for after a while, I was like, why isn't he coming to my games anymore? Or why isn't he, you know, I felt kind of bad. I'm like, does my dad not love me? No, it's because he didn't want to see it all happen over again. He didn't want to be reminded of that. And it was re-traumatizing to him, that whole process. And so I moved from this place where I was kind of neutral and just didn't want to, you know, I was in that inaction stage that Dr. Pee-wee Wardy talked about. I was, you know, just there kind of going through the motions, and it took somebody to kick me in the butt a little bit to get me to move. And with, you know, that intense period of and support from mentors, support from allies, like Susan Hansen sitting right here. Susan, wave to everybody. She's amazing. If you want someone to write letters and comments on news articles that are somewhat at least, you know, positive and productive, she's your woman. But it was really, it was such a group effort here in Oregon. It was just, and I think there's a lot to be learned that we could replicate throughout the country. So if you hear of other states wanting to push this, definitely encourage them to give us a call and talk about coalition building and making all of our schools safer places. I'm definitely interested in replicating this. Not sure that I have enough energy to go the route that Suzanne is going, but I'm definitely there to fight the local fight and not deaf to the concerns of communities. So, I mean, I think that's important too, is to listen to people like my husband. And it's hard, but you know, you have to build those bridges and always keep the door open, because eventually I think folks get it, you know, they just, something clicks in them and all of a sudden they're like, oh, right, so that's real. What we saw up there today before the presentation started. And I love that, you know, this always kicks off with Naya dancing, because that's real. You know, that is real. The things that we had to witness and see and experience, that's not real. That's some made up, messed up craziness. But what was up there on that stage, that was real. So I'm like, oh, you know, it's just, it's so nice to be able to be someplace where you can feel like you can bring your full self to that place. And I'm just so honored that, you know, particularly this intergenerational panel, folks who have gone before and done this work. Man, I was in class watching your video, and I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't think I could ever do anything like that. Look at her, she's so amazing. And now I just feel so honored, right? Sitting, it's just, I had a moment earlier back there. I was like, would she feel weird if I asked her to take a picture with her? Like, I mean, it's just, I feel like I'm meeting a superstar, right? It's just amazing, the power of these folks. So that's what's happening locally. And I'm sorry it took a lot of time, but if you have any questions, let me know. Sam right there is filing a lawsuit. So that's another way to be involved in. Because we don't want to see a loophole. A loophole would dilute our rule, and we want the law to stay upheld as much as it can.
Thank you, Siadam. I think that the story of Oregon is really important, and it speaks to a lot of lessons of this fight. And so what you talked about really touches on a lot of the things that all of us are engaged in. So thank you so much for sharing that story. And while Caitlin is collecting cards, if anyone has them, one of the things that we've been kind of talking around in this conversation, everyone talked about this sort of moment of encounter of coming to activism in this cause and the things that brought you there. And Charlene talking about seeing her children at the University of Illinois, and that moment of realizing that they're encountering these spaces, these images, and that's the environment that they're being raised in, and wanting a better future for them. So the spirit of educating others and honoring the path that you've taken, when people ask you, why do mascots matter? Why is this an issue when we have so many other big things to worry about, when we have real and dire pressing things in our communities? What's the one sort of statement, the one line that you tell folks about why mascots matter? And we can, we'll start, well, since I mentioned Charlene, maybe we can start at that end.
Mascots and stereotypes dehumanize, period. When you dehumanize a people, then they disregard our tribal leaders. When you dehumanize a people, they don't see us as human, so they dig up our gravesites. When you dehumanize a people, as done so publicly, our young people do ask us what's so wrong with being who we are. When you dehumanize a people, then we're vulnerable to acts of racism and hate. And racism is never trivial. So I try to keep it really simple. Racism is never trivial. You know, and this is racism.
Why does mascots matter? I mean, the Indian mascots? Well, it's a perception of people's, what they see is reality. And to me, it's myth-making. I mean, that's where my lens is. But some people might not be able to see that. It's because we live in such a colorblind society. And then if you're going to be a professional teacher, you have to put on your multicultural, multi-tribal lens. But if you're not able to see that, then you're continuing a legacy by design that we're not supposed to be here. We're figments of American imagination. And of course, it follows suit with Hollywood and many other people that have designed and manufactured our image, which includes our own people, because if we fall into that paradox, then we become very colonized to that, and therefore we become the Indian mascot. So many people don't see that, particularly our own people, which is a form of recolonization, because if you have not learned, you're recolonizing, you're continuing the legacy of colonization. And that's a critical thinking piece. I mean, to me that's very simple, but you know, that's, I've been only processing it for 30 years, so, but that's been a lot of time doing it, and that's why it's rolled into more of the academic, more of the psychological discourse, rather than just something really novice. But you know, when you're in college and universities, then you begin to understand that, particularly with those that are in Native American studies. I mean, this is very much a prominent topic, and then of course that's when they start to pick up all the scholarship, and they see all of the work that the professionals have been able to do and use that. And I'm very proud of that, because one of my first lessons for my students is to cite your native scholars. I mean, that's really important to me, because they've laid the foundation for what you're learning today. And so you move on, and don't forget that, you know, they've had that struggle a long time ago, and so you move in. So it matters, because it's about our people, it's about our children, it's about the seventh generation. We don't want this to be happening to another generation or two, that we're still fighting this conundrum of manufactured images. To me, it's an issue of a white possessive investment, because it was white performance that created this in the early days of Carlisle Indian School. And so that's where it was designed. And so that's imprinted in the American psyche. And so to undo that is through critical thinking. And so that's why I say it's a possessive investment in whiteness, because it's mostly the white male that wants to keep it. And it's that ideology which is bought into by our own people. That's called colonization. And the antidote is decolonization. It's very simple. It's a critical thinking process that we go through those lenses. And so that's why it matters to me.
Thank you. I have three kids and one on the way, I wish I could bottle it all up into this really simple moment when I was at Target with my family, and in Washington D.C., you know, the team is so prominent. they have like their own aisle, their own section, that's just, you know, jerseys and hats and t-shirts and all that stuff. And one day I went, we went, and my daughter, who is inherently aware of her Indianness, like I haven't had to really help her understand anything, she just seems to know it. And we were there, and she started acting weird, and she was just like, she was in a huff, and she was upset, and she was mad, and she was just acting strange. I finally pulled her aside, and I'm like, what's your problem? What are you doing? And she just goes, I just don't get it, Dad. I don't understand why they're making fun of us. I think if you could take any person with a heart and just capture that moment to hear a child, a six-year-old child, say, why are you making fun of us? That it puts into perspective where the issue lies. I think it's important because I think it is the most incredible example of the inept relationship that America, American culture, Americans, who non-Indians, whatever you want to say, has with indigenous people. And that's a relationship that has been inept from the very beginning. And it continues to be inept. And it continues to have problems. It's the only reason why things like the Lone Ranger and Tonto was able to be produced for multiple millions of dollars and exist, because the relationship is inept. And so it's really important to me. And a caveat to what you're asking is, and I hear this from a lot of people, there are bigger issues in Indian country than this issue. That might be true. I like to counter that question, though, with, like, really, what bigger issues are you working on? Are you working on the big issue about the Lakota woman that froze to death in her house because she didn't have enough heat to warm her house? Are you dealing with the kids that are being taken from their homes in Indian through private adoptions and are foregoing the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978? You know, what is it that you're doing to enact change and enact a contribution to Indian country that's more important than this issue? Because unless you're doing something else, it's lip service. And if this is such a simple issue, if this is so trite that you can dismiss it with these other more important issues, then it should be really simple to just change it and just fix it. So.
Great. I love that. So Greg, I'm actually going to go back to you with the next question. There are a couple of questions about the role of social media in this movement, and Charlene had mentioned that earlier as well. So if you could just speak a little bit about particularly the role of Twitter and some of this twactivism that's been going on.
Can we put up his slides so that we can see him? I think he's got a...
Yeah, can we put up possible? Like the mural and the couple other things? By the way, twactivism sounds like Daffy Duck is trying to say something. He's like, twactivism. changing the world in 140 characters or less. Well, I mean, social media, I think in social media is important, and not just Twitter, but because there is Instagram, you can do videos, and of course, Facebook. You know, there was the big thing that happened with the fracking up in Mi'kmaq and up in Canada. And there was a complete media blackout in the United States about that. In fact, if you went to any Canadian news sources that were reporting on the protests that were happening that were about the fracking on Indian lands, you could not access in America the stuff that was coming up in Canada. Like, it was literally like, you cannot view this in this country, which is frightening to me. It's through social media that I was able to know everything that was going exactly as it was going, because that information was being fed through videos and photos and, you know, sharing different talks. And that's the last American Indian on Earth. That's a whole other thing. So information is being shared where mass media or, you know, main media are not reporting on it. But with that comes the fact that a lot of these news sources are starting to accept the weight that some of these social media platforms have. So if you can trend, that's what they call it, which you use a pound sign or a hashtag, and then have a word, so like hashtag change the name. That those things, if they trend, if there's enough of a stink, then media will pick it up and they will have a conversation about it. So there's a lot of things, and I think that this has been the case really, you know, forever. If you look at probably one of the more significant actions that was happening in Indian country and civil rights movements in the 60s and 70s, news sources weren't talking about it. It wasn't really known. In fact, it's not taught in our schools. I mean, I learned about, in the school I grew up in, I learned about the civil rights movement, and Indians are nowhere in the spectrum. It was just the black community, and so you're talking Malcolm X and, you know, MLK and Black Panther Party and everything else, but there's this huge rainbow of color that took place during the civil rights movement. And we're in an age now where if we tweet things, if we put things on Facebook, if we put enough stuff out there, that it gets out there and there's a greater conversation. Because I think the thing that will change the aspect of this is a conversation. And without that conversation, there's no evolution of thought. If you look at gay rights 10 years ago and gay rights now, it's completely different because there's been a conversation between those two points that have changed the conversation and that have informed the conversation. So I think social media is a huge proponent of that. And that's why I do things like this, because it's easy to share. It's visual, it makes the point, and it just spreads like wildfire. It's a good tool, and I think that it's the tool that will help indigenous people have a voice on essentially their own rules and not having to adhere to the rules of you know, Fox News or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So before she leaves, she's talking there in the back. I just want to recognize, so the woman behind the whole, and we're talking about this thing called a Twitter storm. How many people know what that is? Right, when you trend to, okay, yeah. So a lot of, most people know what that is at this time. So basically
lots
you have
of tweets.
Tons of tweets. So this issue is starting to get a lot of attention, particularly in Indian country and in activist circles across the nation, in part because of the woman right back there who's about to walk out of the room. She is the brain behind the Not Your Mascot Twitter storm. This is Jackie Keeler. She's a journalist, freelance journalist for Indian Country Today. Right? All of this happening here in Oregon. Right in Oregon. But that whole, so the Not Your Mascot Twitter storm, the Not Your Tonto Twitter storm that followed, or that was right around the times of the Oscars, because, you know, this disgusting movie that was made about Tonto, what got nominated for an Oscar.
For best makeup.
Wait, so basically it's a, that means it's an Oscar for red face, mm-hmm. which is
yeah.
mind-blowing. That's right. Mind-blowing.
Right. And so all of these things, I mean, fundamentally, there are two things I think that change change public perspective or that ways that we can take power back right now. And one of them is voting, right? Civic engagement, everything that has been, you know, from the very beginning, our country about being involved. And for those of us who are tribal citizens, that duty is double. You need to be involved not only in your state, local, and county government, right? You need to be also involved in your tribal government. That's part of being a part of your nation. And that's so vitally important, I think, for young tribal citizens. I mean, Che, he did go to his tribal council. But you know what? They were like, we don't know. Our mascot is the Indian, so we don't really want to take a stand on this issue. But he was engaged, right? He's engaged as a citizen. The other way to really push the envelope out there, and you know, our 1% or 1 or 2%, if you're in Oregon, our population isn't going to win a popularity vote. Like, we're not going to win a popular election. If we took the mascot issue like they did in South Dakota out to our voters, we would totally lose. But it's going to take people really making people think in critical ways, in innovative ways, like Twitter does, like Facebook does, like Tumblr does. So that people can start to get out of that whole tape that they've been seeing, where the only thing that they realize and know and understand about us are the myth of Thanksgiving and mascots.
That was the extent of the public school education on Indian people, was the myth of Thanksgiving and mascots. That was all they knew about me, where I was from, who I was, and it was so much more complicated than that. Life was so much more complicated than that. And I think the power behind those things, seeing the not your mascot trend during the Super Bowl, that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. That was a huge deal. And then also then following it with the trend about not your Tonto and following it again. I mean, this idea about taking back this free media, I think, is very alive in Twitter, very alive in Tumblr, and that's the extent of my new media knowledge, because I only came on Twitter after coming to this lecture last year. Like, that was my birth into Twitter. I was like, maybe I ought to check out this Twitter thing. Feeling kind of old, but it's amazing and it's powerful.
So we are already over on time, and there's some really amazing and interesting questions here, especially, I think, one of the trends in these questions is asking about, specifically here in Oregon, with the native schools that have native mascots, and if there's a way to do this correctly. And I think that's a really important and interesting issue, but we don't have a lot of time to unpack it. So maybe if those folks are interested, they could talk with Siadam afterward, because I do think that's interesting. But to close the panel, I'd like all of the panelists to share one way that folks can get involved from your perspective. So what's a way that people who are interested in this issue can get involved? And what's one resource that you would point people to who are interested in learning more about this issue? Is there a website? Is there a scholar? Is there someone that you feel that they can turn to learn more? So how can they get involved, and what's a resource? Sure.
Well, let's see. I mean, my stuff's kind of on the abstract in that, I'll speak to this stuff, and I've talked at rallies, and I've done television stuff. I've done all this stuff. And so what it comes down to is a lot of people like my work and like what I do, and so they'll ask if they can support me, and supporting me is supporting an artist. And so I have work that's available. I actually have posters of this image, big prints, like 18 by 24 inch prints, that are in production right now. And so that actually continues to perpetuate me to get materials and to be able to do these things, which a lot of the stuff that you see like this, I do on my own dime and use my own time and just simply donate it because I think it has value as being a free sourced image to people to use for the conversation and for whatever their means. So I have free source images, and then I also have work that's available. As far as a resource, gosh. Back in the day, I started with books, and because before internet, there was books.
Books are still important.
Yeah. Print is not totally dead, people. But the there was a lot of books that changed my life. Now, if you look hard enough, there's a lot of websites, and there's a lot of people on Twitter and on Facebook that are constantly talking about this and constantly putting information out there. So is everything from, the Washington Post piece I had, which is about my performance piece, but actually talks about the mascot issue and the things that happened there, which talks about some of these perspectives that we're talking about, all the way to actual pieces written, by Native people in Indian country. And sometimes there are non-Natives that write about this that create a really interesting platform for this. I think all you have to do is engage it, because there's a lot of information out there. You can Google pretty much anything nowadays, and the information is there. There's contemporary information, and there's even, old school thought information. I know he's not very popular, but Ward Churchill wrote a book that has a whole section. I don't remember what the book is called now. It has a whole section about mascots. Do you remember what it is? Indians Are Us, that's it. But there's a very good piece in there about mascots. And Ward Churchill's very angry, so it's a very angry written piece, but it is so spot on, and it talks about all the comparisons, the flip side to this, like the arguments about, if it's, you know, the Washington Redskins, then, you know, you could have the, you know, San Diego Kikes or whatever. And so it talks about all that, and it's really, really interesting. And that's kind of actually what got my head going about this stuff, was that old book I just happened to pick up at some obscure bookstore in Boston. So that's me.
I'd like to give acknowledgement to the Vine DeLore series, knowing him and being one of my teachers, particularly on this topic, has been writing. I guess he's been chuckling about this so that such long because he's so conscious that this is silliness, this is disconscious racism, and so as you begin to read some of his work, you know, he's probably doesn't want to go into that direction because it's so far beyond of his critical thinking, just to lay it to those that are novice about this situation. But for me, because I'm an educator, it impacts me because it impacts the psychological census of our children, and that's where, you know, for me it had a rub. And so I began to integrate much of what my scholarship was and what I could do to undo this kind of myth-making in schools. And so that's what propelled me to do much of that early scholarship. And then I'm now seeing that is beneficial to many of our school students today. But that rolled into what I call policy. And so I began to be in touch with those that really want to have this radical change. And so early in the 80s, start to writing about this. In the 90s, though, the policy papers began to emerge. And then, first of all, going into my local organization, Oklahoma Council on Indian Education, then we started to form policy papers, and then we put a resolution together for the NIEA, National Indian Education Association, in the 80s. And then because I'm in the circles of multicultural education, then we put a position paper for the elimination of Indian mascots for the National Association of Multicultural Education. And then it moved into social work, and I connected with social work, and they've had a policy on the network of those that are going to be future social workers. And then reached the consciousness of the NCAA. And then in the NCAA, I worked with them in January 11, 2003, looking at my CV here. The NCAA 97th conference of the NCAA, where I talked to athletic directors, about 200 in Anaheim, California, where you could hear a needle drop, a pin drop, because I was talking about the elimination of Indian mascot for about 200 NCAA members, Division I, Division II, Division III, because they didn't want to do this. And so now, next month, I've been invited to come back to the NCAA, give a report on how things have been since we passed that policy. So much of the languaging has much to do with a lot of us in our training in the academic realm. And so here in Oregon, I was asked by then Superintendent of Public Instruction, Susan Castile, July 27, 2010, to give her an update on the scholarship across the country, because this is not unique to Oregon. My experience starts in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, and now here we are in Oregon, and right up north of us, Washington is dealing with the same. So it's a rippling effect, and so I want to just share with you that it's about policy for me now. And so it's simple. I mean, to me, tangible ways to really honor, and I got this down, acknowledge the tribal lands the schools that exist whose indigenous lands is written within each school. Create scholarships for Native students within each one of the school systems. Recruit and hire Native teachers within school system, professional positions. Recruit and hire Native administrators within each school system and professional positions. Elect Natives to local school boards and state board of education. Integrate Native content across K-12 curriculum. Send teachers, administrators, parents, school board members to national conferences and workshops, OIEA, NIEA, NAME, etc. Language tribal sovereignty into the mission statements and strategic plans within each school. Build professional development and collaboration partnerships with the local, regional Native studies departments in higher education or tribal and controlled community colleges. Use ceremony to retire every one of these Indian mascots in schools. Mm-hmm. And then work with the Native community to replace Indian mascots within each one of the schools, and then you really start the healing, the soul wounds. I know these are just a few solutions, but anything is better than being an Indian mascot being used in schools.
Well, once you're done with Cornell's list. So I guess in the interim, though, especially for states who are at a place like Oregon was a couple of years ago, my advice would be to build broad and strong coalitions, right? To reach out to other folks who have been marginalized through policy and ask them to be your ally on this issue. There's nothing harder to push than a strong group of allies standing together. You'll learn so much more about yourself, about their causes, and I think that's what made, when it came time for public comment and for testimony to happen, because our coalition was so diverse, it was hard to poke holes in it for the opposition. It was really tough for them. And when it came time to ask for public comment, the majority of the public comment was in favor of a ban. And that was because we reached out to so many coalition partners and said, please write letters, please write in, and they did. And that that really, I think, was the thing that propelled us to win over the state board. Because the schools had their own clusters, right? They had their own community, and they were all behind it, and they could all write in. So they had kind of a captive audience, but we had to work hard to get our audience and to keep everyone engaged throughout the process. So I think building broad coalitions is important. And then the second thing is stay civically engaged. I think Sam taught me a lot about the legislative process that I didn't know about before, and to encourage especially my academic colleagues who talk a lot about equity and diversity, right, at institutions like this, whether it's here or across the river, you tend to hear a lot of folks talk about equity. And when you hold their feet to the fire and say, okay, you talk a lot, come with me to Salem. And that's, I think, really important, to that civic engagement and hold people accountable for the values that they profess to support. Hold yourself accountable, I think, is important as well.
I think I have the hardest.
The last word.
The last is hardest. Because, what everybody has said is, exactly what we should be doing. The reason that we were able to do what we could do at the U of I was building coalitions. And I had good mentors, we are leaders. We're sitting up here, we're leaders, so our job is to reach back and lift other people up, so they come behind us. One of my important mentors was Kwame Ture, who was a very powerful speaker. And when he came to speak on campus, he understood his role as a leader was to groom new leadership, so he asked to meet with student leaders. And you may know him as Stokely Carmichael. And he could fill an auditorium of it was 1,000 seats, and it was standing room only. And he put me forward. I did not want to talk about this, it was really shy. I used to hyperventilate if there was more than 10 people in the room. And so when I was in the room with Kwame, and they were just introducing themselves, and it got to me, I was hyperventilating really badly, because I was terrified just being in that room with Kwame. And so when it got to me, and I'm going like, my name is Charlene Teeters, and it kind of disappeared because I was forgetting to breathe, And so he goes, I know you.
I have heard all about you. My friend Wabunanini, he has told me about you, he said. Wabunanini is Vernon Belcourt. And he says, he turns to the people who brought him in, and he says, I want you to give the sister 10 minutes of my time, he says. I know, the air went in and didn't come back out for a while. And I'm going like...
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BA.